finances. Well, I think we've slowly advanced to the subject of looking at our nearest star might be operating. And this will come with many flavors, because I think there will be substantial discussion certainly during the last week when we have the overall conference, and it will be revisited a number of times. I thought I would start by just laying out a few things about the solar problem. They're largely familiar to you, but the principal conspirators are here. Since we're dealing with magnetic fields, we have a preference for people with a B in their last name. And I'm hoping that, and there was even there was a Brummel here, but he left town. Ben and Matt and Sasha, who are all here, have been very significant, the dominant players in it, as is Mark Meesh, who will be coming here for the month of July.
Is that your team?
No, it's no middle initials. NMI sometimes on mail that I get. So many of the issues, of course, for the sun is that it's an object where the convection zone is approximately 30% in radius below the surface, has a major density contrast, of course, across it. We've for a long time have felt that the sun has a radiative interior. But heliocosmologists have shown us that we have some interesting boundary layers that are involved. And we have known for well over essentially a century that the sun rotates and appears to rotate differentially by looking at blotches on the surface. On the other hand, I'd like to show you very briefly what we have deduced about heliocosmology in terms of its differential rotation, which was quite contrary to many of the first theoretical efforts that had some views about how it should be rotating. And Gary had a very significant role in some of his early studies also. But as we have been dealing with many objects, there is a close interplay between what is the nature of a differential rotation and what is maybe the type of global magnetic dynamo action that could be realized. And the challenges with this object, and probably with all stars, is that intrinsically there is a vast range of dynamical scales involved. You would say, all right, that's fine. That's, of course, a character of turbulence. But these scales are such that they're very small near the surface, very fast convection there in the form of granulation and supergranulation, and gradually they get broader as one goes deeper. But they all have a joint responsibility in carrying out the full flux of the sun until you hit the radiative conditions on the outside. And heliocosmology, in particular, has shown us that there are two shearing layers, one just below the surface, one in the tachocline. The tachocline one had not been anticipated, I would say. Had been a lot of debate about whether the core might, in fact, or the interior might be rotating 5 or 8 times faster, because we know that we've been spinning down this star based on at least the angular momentum lost from the solar wind and the fact that many stars, when they're like the sun that are assembled, are rotating maybe 50 times faster. This didn't have to be that, but it was likely. So let me just spend a couple of minutes just reminding you of what we know about the interior structure. Heliocosmology is our experimental subject. And if we were to follow ray paths within the sun, they come in two varieties. They're the acoustic in cross-section cut. This is the sun. The ray paths that would be associated with the acoustic modes. The sun is filled with about a few million of these modes. And they're almost all excited by the very small-scale granulation at the surface. And what is interesting with that is that the small-scale granulation, which is extends about the thickness of this line, operates at spherical magnetic degree about 4,000. And it's a little bit like what would happen to you in the course of a very heavy hailstorm, of where your car comes out looking like it's been hit by thousands of little hammers. That surface is being pounded. And so these are all localized delta functions, very small scale, but typically with sort of hammer periods of about 2 to 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. And yet they excite a very broad spectrum of modes, including the L equal to 0 and 1 and 2 and everything else within the sun. So we're now fairly confident that it's really acoustic excitation that is responsible for filling the sun with sound. But we need to have some motions that are nearly sonic, and the granulation at the surface has that property. We had our first sort of organizational meeting concerning heliosismology here at KITP at the time when it was ITP and had only wasn't even in this building in 1990, where we assembled here for 6 months to sort of try to figure out how to do inversions and other things that we could borrow techniques from the geophysicists. But it was a very significant beginning. And then we put together a network of observatories from the ground called the Global Oscillation Network Group, because it sounds like gong, and you kind of hit a hammer. And similarly, we launched a spacecraft called the SOHO, Solar Heliospheric Observatory. And these have been operating since effectively 1991. It would be lovely if the sun also had internal gravity waves whose propagation diagrams look like this. They propagate below the convection zone. The convection zone extends 30% of the way in. These waves would not be propagating within the convection zone. They could tunnel through. They probably should be excited by all the pummeling that the convection zone does near its base, but we've tried mightily to try to see them, and I would say basically we haven't detected them, even with measurements that are in the few millimeters per second in Doppler velocities. So there must be that both the energy within these modes is low enough, their amplitudes are low enough, but the attenuation by this vigorous turbulence of the convection zone kind of kills you off. And we particularly have been looking for spherical harmonic degrees L of 1 and 2 and 3, which have the least attenuation as they go through. But how do we access to them? They would be splendid for probing things like the Brunt-Weissler frequency and other things of the radiative interior. We have some acoustic modes that make it to there, but there are ever fewer. There are a lot of very good coverage just below the surface. All of these waves are turned because the sound speed increases with depth. And so you can steer the waves around. But by the time you get into the tachocline, you have to have spherical harmonic degree about 20 or lesser to be able to get there. And in the even deeper interior, of course, the number of modes gets to be small, and their resolution gets also comparably weaker or much broader. But what the sun looks like this rubbish pile. This is a piece of 20 degrees across on the sun as viewed with one of our helioseismic experiments. It's throbbing away. And one can understand why, when we knew about this, before we knew about 5-minute oscillations and supergranulation, because it looks like a very messy signal. But of course, if you proceed to project these things in long data sets onto spherical harmonics, they can give you data like that looks like this. So in terms of angular degree, spherical harmonic angular degree versus frequency, there are distinctive ridges where power is located. This corresponds to a fundamental mode, the one that has no zeros in its between its upper reflection and the lower reflection point, one with one additional node, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and so on. And we essentially go to almost the 20th or so radial overtone. If we said, well, fine, how many modes are there? Well, in fact, we can trace these ridges out to about 4,000, up to about 100, which corresponds also roughly to the scale of spherical harmonic degree that deals with supergranulation. One can see individual sort of archipelago of power, so that there the quantum rules for ensuring that a wave makes it all the way around before it gets scattered any significantly, that rule is honored. And the low-degree modes, in fact, have Qs, quality factors, such that they change their phase maybe over a few years. So there really are global modes. But beyond that, they become less global because the scattering is and the excitation is beginning to have its effect. But they can still be used to probe properties in localized regions. Something about a comparable sort of theoretical prediction of what it might look like. But what came out of using the frequency splitting of modes that might be traveling east versus west, because each is equally likely, and carrying out an inversion of the order of 100,000 modes, gave us pictures like these of what the angular velocity would look like in the interior. The equator is here, the pole is here. Using global modes gives you only symmetrized responses around the equator. But the main message was that if fast is red in terms of angular velocity and blue is slow, that what we had known for about of the order of 100 years or so about the surface differential rotation certainly is also captured, thank goodness, by the angular velocity deductions from the inversion. We had suspected that there probably was a speed up of rotation rate just below the surface by seeing that different magnetic features rotated at slightly different rates compared to the surface plasma. But in fact, we're very confident that we have a distinctive boundary layer near the surface, which we've come to call the near surface shear layer, that has a property that the angular velocity increases and does so in the upper roughly 5%. And then there's another boundary layer. This is the base of the convection zone, at least where we go from nearly adiabatic to subadiabatic stratification, where we go into effectively uniform rotation. And that has come to be called the tachocline, taco being speed and cline being a layer of change, in the, at least trained by thermocline people. Or if we took similar cuts through this, these accentuate maybe more. So a cut in depth at the equator, 15 degrees, 30 degrees, 45, and so on, it emphasizes that we have certainly a fairly distinctive boundary layer just below the surface. And then all the branches come together. Now, the inversion kernels themselves are such that they are about 7% in width at this depth. They're much narrower near the surface, given the number of modes and the structure of these modes themselves. The tachocline could very well be 1% in depth, but there's no way we can have opinions about that, but we can't resolve it. But we will be putting up another spacecraft for a modest cost of $1 billion or so at the beginning of December, or maybe if the president prevails, where he would like to have his lunar explorer go up before he goes out of office. We might go up then in February. But something called the Solar Dynamics Observatory is going up, and it has a suite of instruments, and one of them is a helioseismic magnetic imager. And it will perform, essentially provide us Doppler pictures, 4,000 by 4,000 pixels every 20 seconds, and do so until we get tired. But that will give us much more resolution in this region. It doesn't help us a lot with trying to resolve here. But it also has vector magnetographs on board, and then imaging instruments for looking at magnetic structures in the atmosphere itself that look like trace, but on steroids. And we will be getting something of the order of 2 terabytes a day. Boom, 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 boom. So how we cope with that and live with that is, it will be interesting to see. But it's an experimental subject in the same way that you have a laboratory. And so many of us have been involved in one way or another with helioseismology, Ellen included, before she saw the light and went off to deal with accretion disks, or particularly this interstellar medium, whatever that is.
Oh, Yuri, it's so dark.
The other thing is we can do a lot also by using just the much higher degree acoustic modes by analyzing small patches. These modes won't make it all the way around, but they know about the resonant properties and the radial direction. And from those, we can infer things about flows below those regions using an inversion over a range of depths. And they've had some fascinating sort of results in terms of showing that there are large-scale meandering flows that respond to active magnetic regions, blue. So the green and the red are magnetic blotches with different polarities. So there are jet streams. We've come to call this solar subsurface weather, so it has a little bit of character to it. But it's very clear that this SSW, or solar subsurface weather, has flows that interact in a fairly complex way from one day to the next day. These are three pictures a day apart at 2 megameters into the sun, 2,000 kilometers into the sun. The radius is 700 megameters. So it's within the shearing layer at greater depths, like 16, so a little over 2% of the way into the sun. Whereas here, we tend to have inflows into the magnetic complexes. There are fairly strong outflows. So there's no doubt that the flows and the magnetism interact. The question is, who pushes whom around, and how do they evolve? And so, pardon me? Well, it's 160 degrees in longitude and 50 in latitude.
60 degrees latitude.
Pardon me?
Longitude, 60 degrees in latitude.
Yeah. Good arithmetic. So whereas these things were formed with a resolution of 15 degrees on the sun, we can now do it with 1 degree. But that also allows you to only look to shallower distances. So the main issue I would say with the sun is that there's no question that it's a magnetic star. We've known this for a long time. But the fact that there are probably two, maybe we call them subtle boundary layers, which is sort of the hallmark of much of fluid dynamics, certainly has become evident. The Tatler line had not really been anticipated. Gary, did you know of anyone who might have thought? We certainly had Bob Dickey suggesting that his theory relatively would be better than Einstein because he would really prefer it to rotate the inside of the sun maybe 5 or 6 times faster and so the J2 for the sun could be different. Very clever guy, but nobody was expecting this. So that's an interesting boundary layer, and we think it's, as you know, a primary conspirator in the operation of the global dynamo. But what is its detailed structure and variability? That has been somewhat probed. There are suggestions that it might have 1.3-year variations in speed up, somewhat controversial. And of course, almost everything that we see at the surface is from fields that have been produced, but they're all living within this near-surface shear layer, and it's a fairly organized, strong layer, and we don't quite understand how it comes about. We have some opinions. Now, the unifying theme, in a way, is the sketch by Nick Brummel quite some time ago that's seen much travel, that if we took a sort of symbolic picture of some of the dynamic elements within the solar dynamo, we, of course, have the photosphere. We see lots of magnetic loops coming up as sunspot pairs, and lots of little things, too. We suspect that these currently are likely to be originating from the organizing shear that occurs within the tachocline, what we might call the seat of the dynamo. But before we pop to that, it's quite clear that there must be a lot of local dynamo action just that even ignores the fact that the star is rotating, associated with granulation, supergranulation, these very intense, fast scales of motion. It's a lovely electrical conductor. A lot of magnetic chaff comes up. Some of it is probably locally produced. Some of it may come from residue from things that have been torn apart. We know that there's, with compressible motions, there's a tendency, a very strong tendency, to pump magnetic fields downward if you have somehow produced them. And Steve Tobias has been an enthusiast in that subject. Now, if you bring some of this magnetic chaff into a region of strong organized shear, which heliosismology tells us is there, and we don't quite know how to maintain it, we have some opinions, it will tend to do stretching, but stretching of all sorts of things, but with various sort of random orientation. Send me any poloidal field or little pieces and I'll start stretching it. So it's a good combing operation. But it may be that there's enough reconnection that is occurring so that large scale, much more organized, low degree toroidal structures would emerge. And if they were strong enough, they would have a chance to experience the joys that many have studied of magnetic buoyancy and structures might rise. Whether they then survive their passage through the convection zone, which is a pretty turbulent and very competing place, may depend upon how much twist and twirl and other things these may have. Undoubtedly, some fraction of it gets shredded, but if Gene Parker's original stories and so on hold true, then this is also the mechanism by which we produce some of the poloidal field, the twist that is put into the structures. But we certainly, of course, do not have anything which is a unified picture, except maybe from the mean field stories or the flux transport dynamos that assume a number of things about pieces and look at the consequences. So what we have been doing, and we were also sort of talking about whether there would be some test cases run, we've been using a code that is a modern reconstruction of Gary Glassmeyer's code jointly, where Gary was involved, but with Tom Clooney and with Mark Meesh and Julian Elliott in writing a revised version of that code. But it's basically spherical harmonic decompositions in the horizontal Chebyshev and the radius. They're anelastic, sort of filtered out the sound waves. And we wanted to have it as a tool that could be used on basically massively parallel machines reasonably efficiently. we take a realistic solar mean stratification, and the things that I'll show you first, we have avoided dealing with either the upper boundary layer, which we can't resolve, and the scales are far too small, and we've also ignored the fact that you can have penetrated motions. Then we have some calculations where you do allow things to penetrate. Very simplified physics, essentially perfect gases. We ignore radiative transfer effects because it's just diffusion in the regions that we live in. We do take into account compressibility because some of these calculations might extend over 30 or 100 in density scale variations. And we have some here reasonably primitive subgrid transport terms. So it's an LES-SGS type of a, and we're exploring various sort of SGS treatments. But the main thing, as Gary pointed out together with Peter Gilman, it's crucial to take into account the global spherical geometry if you want to deal with some of the rebuilding and recycling in the rules. Now, there's a lot that can be done and has been done with localized patches where you look in reasonably exquisite detail at the turbulence, but they don't have the connectivity. And that's the main reason for going into something like this. Now, what can you actually afford to run with these? Well, our hero calculations extend roughly to spherical harmonic degree of about 700 or 800. And in the radial structure, they may extend to 300-400 in the Chebyshev polynomials. You could do more. We can do more. But these can also be run fairly efficiently on about 1,000 processors on whatever is on essentially most of the supercomputers that are currently available. There's a big challenge with all of these codes. This is essentially a pseudo-spectral code, how to be able to use 100,000 processors efficiently. We can't right now, because intrinsically there's a great deal of global communication that takes place. But those machines will become available. So with Sasha's fine hands, here's a view of the sun, our version of a sun, looking at the radial velocities. Downflows are blue, yellows and reds are upflows. We're in a rotating coordinate system at essentially the average rotation rate of the sun. The equators here, the things are tilted. And of course, you see lots of things at lower latitudes marching to the right. They are rotating prograde relative to that coordinate system, and similarly retrograde at high latitudes. And they themselves have a very significant role in establishing a strong differential rotation, about 30% in angular velocity from the equatorial regions to the poles. But they themselves, even in addition to the differential rotation they establish, they're slightly prograde propagating here and retrograde propagating in the slower regions up on top. If we had a more weighty view of the same thing, it tends to accentuate that you have things which are sort of the relics of banana cells at the lower latitudes and then much more isotropic motions at high latitudes. And, of course, with these, in order to understand the strong differential rotation is established, there must be something to first order that is more or less a thermal wind balance. And so we tend to run systems that establish a warm equator, cool mid-latitudes, and then a hot pole. All of that temperature contrast is of the order of 20 Kelvin or so. And with some of these models, we establish a fairly strong differential rotation, fast equator, slow poles, that are reasonably akin to what one sees in the solar convection zone. At least in terms of monotonicity. There are other solutions possible, but they have a significant contrast comparable to what approximately the sun has. On the other hand, we're not capturing near-surface shear layers, and we're not capturing tachocline, and these models have a tendency to still have a fair amount of alignment of the angular velocity with the rotation axis. And the tilts of the helioseismic data was rather more radial, or about 22 degrees would do better. But we'll show you how we can tilt these things around by also taking into account very weak thermal gradients that must be present near the base if you were to have a tachocline. In fact, here it is. One might say, but these calculations don't have a sort of a uniform temperature at the bottom or entropy. If there's a tachocline there, it must have a thermal wind balance within that tachocline itself. And that would correspond, not too much is needed. You need, the temperature here is about 2 million Kelvin. And if you had a temperature contrast of the order of 5 Kelvin from a warm equator to a cooler pole, I'm sorry, the other way around, cooler equator, warm, that would be sufficient to give you a balance in terms of the angular velocity gradients that must be present. And so we tried various combinations of this and found, in fact, that you can, as Matthias Rempel sort of first advocated, that you can turn, with everything else running, these angular velocity profiles slightly around. So that even the presence of a weak boundary layer plays a role. Now, it isn't that you just blindly do this. Everything is churning away with great vigor in here, but they are sensitive to boundary conditions. No great surprise to fluid dynamicists. It is to astrophysicists sometimes. Or you might say, well, how, you have a very vigorous turbulence zone. Why should you feel anything about the boundary layer here and here? But of course, it can have a significant effect. And you haven't lost the contrast. You've just made things much more aligned, somewhat as heliosismology tells us. And there's a paper with Mark on this. Our latest sort of magnetic modeling efforts have essentially tried to push to more nonlinear conditions, which means sort of higher spherical harmonic degrees. We call these KSF, and there's a recent paper on this in the AFJ last few months. And views of what the radial velocity would look like at three depths near the surface, near our surface, in the middle of the convection zone, near the bases like this. And we'll show you that there's significant connectivity of these multiple scales with depth. In sort of a big view of what something looks like, one snapshot in orthographic projection looks like this. And its companion in Mulready view looks like this. Much by going to more nonlinear conditions, you can get smaller scale structures, no great surprise. There's still some alignment, as I'll show you in some movies in just a moment, and we have isotropic structures at higher latitudes with lots of small tornadoes.
It's not just turbulence, it's also density contrast.
Both. Yeah, thank you. And if we chop off the tops just so we can stack two of them together as movies, and something which is really near the top of our convection zone and near the middle, again, radial velocities, it emphasizes, of course, that there are smaller scales evident near the top, as Sasha said, partly because of density contrast a bit, but also the driving, and larger scales evident here. But the main thing is that if we rerun this, let me... Not all buttons work the same. We'll see that some of these things really became downflow lanes. But the hallmark of all of this convection is that although we have multiple scales present, there's connectivity, particularly in the downflow networks. And so that although the horizontal scale of the structures broadens with depth, the downflows remain narrow in these, and they communicate through. So if you said, well, fine, what's the communication time from the upper region to the bottom in this? About 10 days.
Yuri, what resolution are you running?
The circle, up to circle harmonic degree, about 700.
700. How many radius?
256.
And there's no symmetry in longitude?
No. Yeah. And the density contrast...
130, that's the big difference with the previous simulation.
And if we said, well, let's look at something from the equator to about 50 degrees north, how well are you resolving, seeing, what are you seeing? Well, there's a lot of swirling, twirling motion. And particularly, it becomes more prominent as you go sort of higher up. There's a significant evolution in this, and one of the big challenges is how to run these long enough so you can see things how relaxed. But we might appropriately ask, well, what sort of magnetic fields do you produce with this? But I think the first step is you better get some of the hydro getting so you kind of understand it rather than throwing everything in. And as is commendable, we found that essentially the magnetic energy in these, when the dynamos could be self-sustaining, basically the design of a threshold of a, with a magnetic Reynolds number of the order of 300, they would climb in the honored fashion and typically would get magnetic energy, which is about 8% of the kinetic energy within that shell, and still while maintaining a solar-like differential rotation. And if you look, these are effectively run at lower resolution, the scales are also much larger, effectively. Density contrasts are also lower. But if we looked at near the top of the layer at the radial velocities, the radial magnetic field, and the longitudinal magnetic field, one finds that the strongest magnetic fields are basically in the downflow lane systems. And then you have sort of ribbons that twist their way through with rather longer range order here. And the same characteristic is maintained deeper down.
Is that 8% with respect to the differential rotation or with respect to the turbulence?
It's with respect to the kinetic energy of the convection itself. What you pay for.
To have V dot grad V equal to the Lorentz force, so you would expect to be up to 100%.
Well, we'll show that there are some other solutions that. But the field strengths themselves, in the bulk of the zone, peak out at around 3,000, 4,000 Gauss. So they're not trivial fields, but there's just a lot of energy in the convection. But what dominates in these fields is that you have fairly strong fluctuating fields and relatively weak mean fields that emerge from that in terms of the mean poloidal toroidal structures. One can study small patches to see how they interact in terms of where are they located for radial velocity and radial magnetic fields as a function of time as you track regions, what the flows are, what the reconnection events are. They're fairly rich in those details. And Sasha has also looked at, for us, something that would have some heroic character, because this is what the toroidal field looked like, but if you peel it away, you get wreaths, and so that provided a nice Christmas card for the CNRS or something like this. But the main message is, if you just take a shell, you can build fairly strong fields in these systems of the order of 5,000 Gauss, but their mean fields are relatively, really quite low. They do give you a hairy sun if you extrapolate them outside, but... Now, the element that we looked at, and this is just the end, with Matt Browning, among others, was to say, fine, let's repeat some of these calculations, and now let's put a region of penetration, allow the motions to penetrate into a stable region. And we force a Tacker climb by saying that whatever differential rotation the convection itself establishes here, we will force it to vanish beyond a certain point. Otherwise, you'll slowly spin up your radiative zone. So it's a forced tachycline in that sense. On the other hand, the convection establishes and maintains the differential rotation that it wishes. And you get semi-tolerable, but nothing quite as glorious as the helioseismic differential rotation profiles in the bulk. But what was interesting was that the convection thus is churning away, building fields, pumping them down, and quite remarkably, in the region of penetration, you end up getting, if you longitudinally average this thing, fields of one sense in this portion of the tachycline and of the other sense in here for the toroidal fields. And they're fairly strong fields. And so in this region, these are field strengths of about 5,000 or 6,000 Gauss. And it's maintained and sort of cleaned things up. We didn't put a dipole parity or anything particularly special into it. Well, it had a kind of complicated history of where we arrived at this, and we're still studying other possible solutions. But it built strong, organized fields, as at least as the elements of a dynamo might prefer. Not strong enough to burst or do anything else, but we're continuing sort of looking at the issues of what other types of sort of possibilities might arise and what the histories may be. And if you said, well, so fine, what does it look like in the middle of the convection zone? It's pretty much like the other rubbish of lots of fluctuating fields and fairly strong. But deeper down, the stuff has been swept out. There's been sufficient reconnection. And the toroidal, large-scale toroidal fields prevail. So we think that these are elements that at least allow us to say, well, we're making some contact with at least some Gedanken experiments with a solar system. It's really tough to deal with the near-surface shear layer. I think we have a better chance with the tachocline, but they're all fairly forbidding because there are also very different timescales involved in this system. We're really running it with, well, significantly enhanced diffusion rates compared to the real sun, but otherwise with fairly large density contrasts with the rotation rates in conformity with what we think the sun is doing. And we're at least confronting the helioseismic data, which is a real pleasure because it puts some constraints on the wild wishes that we might wish to have otherwise. So thank you.
With your tachocline experiment, does the magnetic field alternate?
In time?
Yes.
No, it has flipped once, and we're exploring whether it may wish to flip again or what other conditions might arise. But this is, it flipped into the state and it's been sitting there.
Yeah, so I mean, it turns out that actually you end up in this sort of anti-symmetric state, even for purely symmetric initial conditions, or for others as well. So it seems to establish this kind of thing, but the overall clarity has been pretty stable. So we haven't seen cycles, for example, although we've only run it for, I mean, these are tough calculations, so it's sort of 25, 30 years of total evolution.
Yes, Gary.
The magnetic diffusivity, is that a turbulent one, or is that something close to the
real? No, it's a turbulent one.
It's far from the real value.
Yeah. Very, very far.
We have the advantage in the geodynamic community that you can actually use the real magnetic diffusivity. The other diffusivities are huge compared to what they should be, but the magnetic diffusivity is actually the one that you think you're supporting.
Well, it's a Gedanken experiment in the sense that they're toys. We can make these dynamos operate at Mach Prandtl numbers of 2 or 3, maybe even a half, but not at 10 to the minus 2.
Not at the solar rate, at least.
Yeah.
So then we discuss that.
When you say you're in it for 20 to 30 years, what does that mean?
You time march it in time steps of 10 seconds and do so for 20 years.
What's the diffusive time scale?
Right. So, I mean, the diffusive time scale is depending on how you define it.
A little louder?
Sorry. So, I mean, the magnetic diffusive time in these simulations is of order of several years. So you're still only able to run these things for more than a diffusion time, but not orders of magnitude more.
Lunch is being brought in for the.
I have to understand that the convective overturning time is 30 days. The convective overturning time is about 30 days.
Right.
So if you compute 30,000 days, you're in good shape.
But your clock is based on the correct rotation period.
Right. Right. Yeah, we haven't done the thing of scaling up the luminosity and scaling up the rotation period as well. This is all.
So the rotation period is correct, but the magnetic diffusion
time
is correct. Did I understand the first calculation didn't have a tachocline?
That's right. It had a slippery bottom.
And do you know the stratification? What's the problem with putting a tachocline in and just doing the whole thing?
Well, one of resolution. I mean, if you said, let's put a real tachocline in, It will radiate gravity waves like mad. We don't know what its structure is, how it's maintained. If there are two lines of advocacy and other refinements of why it is that you maintain a boundary layer that may be a 2%, it should just otherwise diffusively broaden and march its way in as if you had the star around for about 4 billion years, which would easily get down. But it doesn't. So if you confine it by perhaps building a magnetic boundary layer from essentially a residual magnetic field that was probably present at the time that you organized the star, you do it possibly by the fact that since you're in a stable stratification, the mixing in the horizontal would probably be significantly enhanced over what it would be in the radial direction, a little bit like two-dimensional turbulence that you have in stable stratified oceans. or do you have some other measure of things? We really do not have a, we have some ideas about how attack decline is maintained, but there's no self-consistent model that has been built. So we were going to the simpler route of saying, what if you just have basically slippery boundaries, you carve out a portion. So we've studied the manner in which differential rotations can be established. Now, that is an artificial problem, but it's been fairly instructive to see what classes of, how much differential rotation can you maintain, what is it sensitive to in terms of possible boundary conditions.
What you are learning is that Reynolds stresses on the equator world. So that's what the correlation between V theta and V phi are dominant. And they are mostly opposed by the transport of angular momentum by meridional flows. So mostly the differential rotation is dynamically established. Then that said, the profile of the differential rotation seems to be linked to latitudinal heat transport, linked to a correlation between the temperature fluctuation and the latitudinal velocity. And there seems to be a role played by the Taco Klein in tilting the isocontours of omega toward a more conical profile than signals. The amount of the proportion between self-established latitudinal heat transport in a convection, in a turbulent convection zone, and the impact of a thermal boundary layer that is a Taco Klein is still subtle. It seems that in our computation, it's about 20%, 10 to 20% played by the Taco Klein, and the remainder made by a convection transport. But this is still a debate, and so we still try to understand and pin down that more precisely.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you again.
I'm going to continue our story, and we're going to look here at some simulations of stars like our sun, but rotating more rapidly. As Yuri mentioned in his talk, our sun has a solar wind that's continually removing angular momentum from the system, and this slowly spins the star down over the giga years. And there are lots of observations of young solar-like stars showing them rotating more rapidly. And in those observations, you can also see scalings of the differential rotation at the surface of the star, which can be measured through about three different methods that essentially rely on tracers on the stellar surface and your interpretation of the tracer's propagation rate as compared to the star's rotation rate and the change of that over solar cycles. And also the amount of magnetism that's inferred in these other stars. You can go looking for magnetic signatures in stars by looking at emission and calcium lines and an ultraviolet and an X-ray. And when you look at the more rapidly rotating stars, you see that there tends to be a strong scaling of things like the X-ray luminosity with the rotation rate of the star. And that's usually inferred to mean that possibly the magnetic fields are stronger on those stars or have a much higher filling factor, which tells us that the dynamos operating in solar-like stars feel the rotation rate, and then in more rapid rotation, you might have substantially different dynamos. Well, you might have dynamos that are operating that have stronger fields or more complex fields at the surface that are reconnecting more often. So we got curious about what happens when you take a toy model in the ASH code, and you spin it more rapidly. What do you get? What do we get in terms of both the differential rotation and then the magnetic fields that are generated, which are these images floating in the background here? Again, we've taken models here that don't have tachyclines. These are simulations just of the stellar convection zone, spanning from about 0.72 R-sol up to about 0.96 R-sol. And so these have less density contrast than KSF, are somewhat less turbulent and less finer scale, but can be run at substantially lower resolution. And we found rich behavior both in the hydrodynamic models and then in the dynamo models that we've pursued since then. So very briefly on the hydrodynamic models, this is what our sort of comparison solar model looks like in the same reference range. Or same parameter space. So we still have substantial asymmetry between the upflows and downflows. We have a much more aligned north-south sort of banana cell network at the equator than in the more turbulent simulations, where at the surface, at least, that gets obscured by finer scale structure. Here it remains a visible dominant feature, but one that still exhibits horizontal branching. And again, the different character of convection at the poles, where it's more isotropic. As we rotate more rapidly, we've followed a particular path through parameter space where we've also dropped our turbulent diffusivities to keep our convective driving relatively strong, because as you increase the rotation rate, you increase the critical Rayleigh number and the constraints on convection. But we followed one particular path, and we've maintained vigorous convection as we've gone up to about 10 times the solar rotation rate, and we found some curious characters along the way. Namely, we get a striking modulation in longitude at the equatorial regions of the convection, where you can have regions of greatly enhanced convection and much weaker convection. And if you rotate them rapidly enough, you can actually collapse essentially all the convection in the equatorial region into a single nest that propagates along and persists for thousands and thousands of days, with just strong streaming differential rotation flows in between. These have been seen in a number of, in some geodynamo simulations, actually by Grote and Busi back in about, I think, 2001. Theirs had a somewhat different character, but very interesting to find them here. And they're living here in a range that's perhaps more turbulently driven, as we have a lot more polar convection, and theirs had been almost a linear onset problem in the Boussinesq system. Sasha and Jerome have also found these things in exploring younger suns with deeper convection zones. These ones here all have similar convection zones, though the depth of that would have evolved as the stars evolved themselves. Despite the strong modulation in longitude, they actually retained very very smooth differential rotation profiles, but we'll go back to that in a moment. So just sort of for a movie of what these things look like, you have structures propagating through the convection, you have things with multiple characteristic velocities, individual banana cells swim through the nests of convection, the differential rotation also swims through at the surface, but streams in the opposite sense at the bottom of the convection zone. Very rich structures living within a strongly shearing flow. And these persist in a number of our dynamo simulations as well, which had not been found in the geodynamo simulations. So I think that's largely a problem of location and parameter space. So sort of a cautionary tale that there are very interesting structures that can arise in these convecting systems, especially when we're observing things like stars and inferring rotation rates from tracers like sunspots at the surface. If they feel structures like these in the convection zone and are advected along, they may be propagating substantially differently than the mean zonal plasma flow or other items. And this may have some bearings on features in the sun.
So what is the Rossby number for convection?
The Rossby number is roughly, call it 0.3 or so.
Does that stay constant
there
when you go on your path?
No. No. The Rossby numbers vary from about 1 in the solar range down to about 0.1 at about 10 solar. Convective and fluctuating Rossby numbers are scaling relatively similar. So we're keeping, in a sense, the amount of vorticity is remaining relatively constant across the parameter space, despite us spinning it much differently and being at a much higher Rayleigh number. Those later ones are probably two orders of magnitude up in Rayleigh number, maybe sort of factor of 50 up rather than 100, somewhere in that range.
So Ben, you're saying your convective Rossby number, there's buoyancy over equatorial.
And that one is the convective Rossby number is comparable to the fluid vorticity over omega Rossby number.
How does that vary with you?
There's some scaling to it, but it's sort of all.
Does it increase, decrease?
It decreases as we go to more rapid rotation.
some ways, you're fixing the flux through the system so that the convective velocities are not changing very much.
Yeah. All of these have a solar luminosity going through them. So they have the same amount of flux. They have actually substantially similar fluctuating velocities for their peak velocities. Though in the more rapidly rotating things, you build a very strong differential rotation, and that can actually shear out the structures, especially at the radius, and shear out their connectivity. So rather than penetrating the full convection zone, convective structures actually just will penetrate maybe a third of it, except for the strongest, which manage to bridge from the top of the convection zone to the bottom. So the strongest structures, in a sense, feel the full density stratification, which in these simulations is about a factor of 30, whereas sort of the medium amplitude structures maybe only sense a pressure scale height or so in their motions before they get truncated by shear. And we think that that's a substantial part of the story of how you get these propagating long-lived activeness of convection. It's some balance between the shear and the convective structures and their driving. We see, so one of the observables in stars is the scaling of differential rotation with rotation rate, which is often measured either as a delta omega, a sort of average difference from something like the pole, something like the equator up to something like the pole, but integrated over the disk of the star, or its ratio normalized, or that normalized by the rotation rate. But just looking at delta omega straight up, which is sort of your ingredient that would go into a dynamo theory, what we see is that in the hydrodynamic things, so this is sort of what the solar differential rotation profile looks like, and here's one of the more rapidly rotating ones. This one's at 5 times the solar rotation rate. And they're substantially similar in their structure. They have fast poles, fast equators, slow poles, substantial contrast across the entire convection zone, both in radius and in latitude. And if you take a difference between, say, the equator at the surface and about 60 degrees at the surface and plot that up, then in latitude it looks like this. And if you take maybe 15 degrees and take the top to bottom difference, then that radial shear looks like this. So both of them are growing substantially. So if you want to run a dynamo, you have a lot of mean shearing flow available to you to do it with. And this differential rotation has been established by Reynolds stresses, and it's been maintained partly by the creation of a strong thermal wind. There's, in this case here, the 5 solar case, the pole is about 100 Kelvin hotter than the spherical background state, and the equator is sort of, well, actually it's about 80 hotter, about 20 cooler at the equator for a total contrast of almost 100 Kelvin. You go up to 10 times the solar rate, and that contrast becomes almost 300 Kelvin. And that's very interesting, because we may actually, in the sun, here you said we have a contrast of maybe 20 Kelvin equator to pole in our models. And that contrast has not been observed at the solar surface. But observations of the latitudinal temperature contrast at the solar surface are very hard. It's possible that observations of more rapidly rotating stars may show us whether or not there are substantial thermal gradients from equator to pole, because that gradient appears to be growing substantially as you go to more rapid rotation. And with Kyle Augustin, one of the other grad students in our group, we've done some explorations of F-type stars, which have much thinner convection zones and more luminosity, and those can build contrasts of thousands of Kelvin. So you might actually be able to test whether or not this mechanism is actually present in stars soon. So let's look at the dynamo story. This is energy traces for a dynamo at 3 times the solar rotation rate. And the red tones, which will be shown in more detail later when they're more interesting, are magnetic energies, and the blue and green tones up here are kinetic energies. The top one is the energy in the mean shearing flow, the differential rotation. And this is the convective kinetic energy. And the ohmic diffusion time of this is about 2,000 days, roughly, to diffuse across the entire convection zone. And from a weak seed field, we ramp up, saturate, and it just sits there fairly steadily and fairly happily.
And the star rotates in how many days?
So 3 times the solar rotation rate is about once every 10 days, roughly. And again, we're sort of in a Rossby number of about 0.3 range, roughly. If we ask whether or not this dynamo is steady or whether it's flipping, one sort of crude way that I've looked at that is to take integrals and to get averages of the radial field over the northern and southern hemisphere. And so if the blue and red lines cross each other, then we've had an actual reversal of the poietal field. And during the initiation, there's sort of a little excursion, we'll call it, but then things are relatively, they're not really steady, but they're staying of similar sign, with sort of an overall field strength of about 20 Gauss, roughly, in each hemisphere at the surface, and that's averaged over a substantial region. This is what the magnetic fields actually look like that are being generated in the simulation. This was done at a magnetic Prandtl number of a half. And we've built striking large-scale toroidal magnetic fields. I'm showing here volume renderings of the longitudinal magnetic field, B phi, and we're looking from a latitude of about 45 degrees, and we're looking down into the center of the star and then through and out to the back end, so we're at about 45 degrees north, roughly. These two bands of toroidal magnetic field straddle the equator, and it's been very surprising to us that you could build global scale structures like this in the middle of the convection zone. When we've tried it in the solar simulations, we just get the small scale chaff that Yuri was showing for that what we call case M3, where there's some mean field that can be seen when you average things over substantial periods, but there's basically very, very strong fluctuating field that obscures it almost entirely. Here, we have these very visible and robust tubes, and the convection is still vigorous. You can actually see it punching into the tubes where there's sort of little sawtooth characters there. And that's been interesting. The field strengths here are about 15 kilogauss for the color tables, but there are peak field strengths buried in some of these regions of 40 kilogauss easily, of both signs. And the two colors here are two polarities. So blue runs this way and red runs this way. So that's been a thing of some glory. If we look at where these are actually coming from, so now I've averaged that magnetic field shown here at right in longitude and scaled all these to the peak values, and we're getting average strengths of about 15 kilogauss sort of rooted at the bottom of the convection zone. We can try and disentangle where those fields are coming from. There are about 6 terms in a decomposition of the induction equation, and I've shown 2 of them. And these are sort of 2 of the interesting strong ones. There's substantial creation of the tube polarity by the differential rotation and the mean shearing flow. So blue here, red here corresponds to building red here and blue there, with sort of unraveling of those tubes at the edges where we have the opposite color.
Yeah, but it's just all over, so that's what we could call it later.
Yeah, right. And over time. Here I've averaged it over about 150 days. And this is, as I said, in a sense, a steady state. That movie was over about 50 days. You could see the tubes were not really changing in either strength or in structure over that time. So this is sort of a very interesting dynamo case to probe some of those things. Since they are steady in strength, there are things that have to be constantly disassembling the tubes to offset the fact that the differential rotation is trying to build them. And one of the strong ones is the fluctuating, the shear from the convective structures. The fluctuating advection is similar in sign, or it's similar in spatial distribution and in amplitude to this, and those two together seem to do much of the job of balancing against the differential rotation. So fluctuating advection, fluctuating shear, which we'll see in a moment in an image, balancing against substantially the mean shear. And this is just in the creation of the toroidal component. The poloidal component we still need to look at in some detail, but just sort of what the poloidal field looks like in structure, these are poloidal field lines of that M equals zero component, where the colors denote the sense of the field lines and the contours are actually showing field lines. So we have a potential field top boundary condition, so the radial field is poking out there. We have a perfect conductor bottom boundary condition, so you can see things getting deflected as they come down. And they're sort of wound up tightly, and they're just a little bit offset. The sort of center for that is about here. It's offset a bit from the tubes. And the field strengths get up to about 5 kilogauss in comparison to the 15 on the left. And those strongest fields are right down here at the bottom and a little bit in this boundary region. So we have it's a very interesting structure. I mean, this has a large-scale field that comes around, but also this this higher-order pole living down there. And these things in volume renderings look about like the following. So this is a snapshot from the middle of that movie. We're seeing just a limited portion of the domain, about a third of the sphere, and the color sense is the same. The striking thing here is that while the tubes are very organized and coherent, they're very leaky, and magnetic fields, say here, over short distances come up, exit the tubes, and get wound up by the cyclonic convection in the polar regions. So they're not monolithic in a sense. So the last part of the story is I've run through a substantial number of simulations that cover a fair bit of both rotation space and also turbulent driving space, Rayleigh number space, where we've tried to increase that to see whether or not the answers that we're getting still hold at higher Reynolds numbers. And in some spots in the parameter space, you can get steady dynamos, like that three solar one I showed you. But in some places, you can also get dynamos that either oscillate or actually flip and reverse their sign. So here's one of these characters. This is at 5 times the solar rotation rate. And we're looking at about a 5,000-day period that's moderately late in the history of the simulation, so it's already equilibrated before we even begin our traces here. But we can see that the energy in the differential rotation goes through oscillations, and there are also oscillations in all three components of the magnetic energies. This is the mean poloidal energy, the mean toroidal energy, and the fluctuating magnetic energies. And as those oscillate, they sometimes correspond to actual poloidal field reversals and toroidal field reversals as well. So that's been fascinating. They're not, you can see from this that it's fairly ratty and ragged, and we have excursions that sometimes are not successful flips but come back with the same sign. But this has been very interesting and maybe telling us important part of the story of how stellar dynamos operate. As a last note, in these sort of exchanges of energy, the convection is retaining at essentially the same amplitude all the way through. It has stochastic variations, but no large-scale variations. So, anyways, these have been a lot of fun, and I have for the first time started building this globally organized fields in the middle of a convection zone and ones that can also oscillate, at least in the stellar context.
Yeah, welcome, please. Oh, so I'm interested by these oscillations. I think there are various different routes that could be proposed for getting oscillations in your differential rotation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also had ones where the differential rotation switched off the shear, and then the differential rotation switched off the convection, and then the convection.
Right.
It looks like yours is magnetically driven.
Yeah, and if you actually, if you look at a movie of what the differential rotation is doing, you'd see the, it retains a substantially similar character, but its amplitude increases and decreases. So you see the contours almost breathing in and out as it goes through these oscillations.
This is more like, if we're doing a mean field model, this is like Malkus Proxer effect in operation.
Mm-hmm.
And there are various theories for how the period of that oscillation should scale.
Hmm.
Only the large scale field where here it seems that the fluctuation perhaps also plays some role.
Well, then you have the lambda tension.
What we find that when we were doing all the other stars is that you can clearly see there is a lag. You have to have the growth of the magnetic energy before seeing the decay of the differential rotation energy, so there is some lag, and you can see that it's linked.
That's what I understand.
But it seems that after a certain level, if you get too much magnetic energy, you will then quench the differential rotation to an extent where this breathing phase doesn't exist anymore. So we have cases in A-stars with Matt Browning where we clearly saw that we were having this breathing situation, and then we increased the rotation rate and magnetic energy was so high over equipartition that suddenly all the differential rotation disappeared and you got a much more boring simulation. So there are certainly space parameters where you get that breathing.
And the most rapidly rotating solar simulations start doing that a little bit too. The differential rotation energy actually gets dropped and remains the entire time substantially below the convective kinetic energy, and it almost, the oscillations almost decouple.
See these things where they switch off in so the field gets so large
that it quenches out the eventually. And your blue line up there suggests that you have a large change in total kinetic energy when the blue line drops.
Right.
So does it get...
We think it's coupling into the thermal reservoir.
So you see the thermal energy increase at that time?
We don't, because we're not outputting at a high enough precision. The thermal energy is so large that these changes on it don't show up in single precision.
Double precision, yes.
So we think that that's where it's got to be going, but we haven't actually checked that yet.
I looked at that in some of the models where we'll put it in double precision, and it's from the thermal reservoir more than from the production.
You mean you're printing it out from single?
Yeah, the output file, the scalar trace is... So you will not see, because this is 10 to the 13 for the thermal energy, where the kinetic energy is 10 to the 6. So this slight change is just at the last digit of your single precision number.
And that's only in the outside. That's not
going to be taken care of.
No, we do. In some version, we have it output in double precision.
You mentioned that in the 10 omega zero case, there's the motion is less. That means the distribution of the motion deviates drastically from axis symmetry.
Yes.
And then I would expect that also the magnetic field deviates drastically from axis symmetry. It was not visible in the 3 omega case.
No, and that modulation gets much stronger as you increase the rotation rate. It's still unclear what actually controls that modulation strength, but a crude knob has been rotation strength. And so the magnetic simulations at 10 and 15 times the solar rate show similar nesting behavior with strongly concentrated, especially radial fields, and it's had strongly disrupted toroidal fields there.
Right.
But yes.
Thank you. And we thank...
Okay, so I guess the upshot of a lot of what Yuri said earlier is essentially that the upshot of a lot of solar dynamo work has been that having a tachycline is quite handy. That this internal boundary layer between a convection zone and a radiative core, we think plays pretty significant role in kind of ordering, generating the large-scale ordered field that you see in the sun, although there's also small-scale chaff. And so the thing I want to talk about in the next few minutes is just, you know, what happens in stars that don't have that kind of interface? Because it turns out that as you go to lower and lower mass stars, the convection zone deepens, and you know, eventually the full interior is convective. Just to remind you of where we sit.
They dropped you off the zoo, you said yesterday.
Yeah, they did, actually. Yeah. The Santa Barbara Airbus is right by the zoo. Anyway, just to remind you of where we live, the convective envelope, the sun, of course, you have a convective envelope and a mostly radiative core. More massive stars have convective cores and radiative envelopes. But as you go to lower mass, the convective envelope deepens, and eventually you're convective throughout the full interior. So you can't really have this internal boundary layer that we think plays a big role in the sun. These changes, by the way, are driven mostly just by variations in the temperature gradient you need to get out, coupled with opacity. So that's where you have convection. There are a couple of observational points that are worth mentioning before we go on to the models. And the first of those is that almost all these fully convective stars are highly active. They show an enormous amount of magnetic activity. This is looking at the fraction that show basically strong H-alpha emission as a function of mass. The transition to full convection occurs around here. So everything over here is fully convective. This turns out to be about activity fractions of 80% or something. So the vast majority of these low-mass stars are apparently building fields. Intuitively, you might think...
Fraction of time?
No, this is a fraction. If you go out and look at volume-limited survey of M stars, 80% of them are active right now. Now, that effectively tells you something about it's also telling you something about the spin down of these stars, because as Ben said, rotation is correlated to magnetic field activity, and so this is also a statement about what fraction of these stars are rotating rather rapidly. The early M's, you almost never see detectable rotation. So there's a lot of stuff that you could go into here about how the spin down is changing as a function of mass that we don't really understand. But the thing that we do understand is that they have strong surface magnetic fields. And you might think intuitively, maybe that's okay. Maybe you have this feeling that convection coupled with rotation and conductivity will always give you dynamo action, but that maybe that field is just a small-scale disordered one. That's harder to probe, but the observations suggest that that's not the case either. So recently there's been some work on Zeeman-Doppler imaging of these fully convective stars. This is essentially using time variation of magnetically sensitive lines to try to infer something about the surface magnetic field distribution on these stars. And the claim is that the data are really inconsistent with a very small-scale field, that there's certainly small-scale stuff present that isn't detected by this stuff, but that you really do need a large, low-L field as well, and some highly axisymmetric components to the field. And yet, at the same time, they're also able to get a handle on the differential rotation, and they find that there really isn't any surface differential rotation to speak of. So it's not as though you are building differential rotation self-consistently within the convection zone, and that's stretching out the field and giving you this large-scale organization. So that's the kind of motivation. And as you would probably have guessed from the fact that I'm talking after these guys, we're using ASH. This is the same sort of game. So these are highly simplified models. Simulations running on massively parallel supercomputers. Like any simulation of this sort, we're doing some pretty vast simplifications to the physics, and Yuri's already talked about those a little bit. I'm basically modeling most of the interior of these fully convective stars of about a third of solar mass. I have to cut out a small portion of the interior, so there is an inner boundary layer, but it's rather small. And I also cut off something in the outer envelopes, just because the scale and the typical time scale and size scale of convection, again, becomes so small in the outer layers that you have to cut it off somewhere. One of the most striking things that emerges from simulations like this is that you see, just in the hydro cases, you see that the convection is somewhat solar-like in the outer radii. So you have these broad, fairly weak upflows and more compressible, fast, narrow downflows. Now, this is radial velocity on two different surfaces, by the way. But that deeper down, it's much more quiet. You have this large-scale flow. It's much weaker. And that's driven by a few different effects. And one of them is simply stratification, that the density scale height is quite a bit larger in the deep interior. Part of it's just geometry, you know, flows are converging on these small spherical surfaces. But there's another effect that comes from energy transport. And if you look at the energy transport in these stars, basically the thing to take away, this is the luminosity carried by different agents as a function of radius. This is the radiative luminosity, and this is the convective one. And the thing you find is that the radiative, that even though the star is fully convective, radiation actually carries much of the energy in the deep interior. And that's a statement that's dependent on kind of relying on a 1D stellar model's prescriptions for radiative opacity. But if you put in essentially the temperature profile, basically an adiabatic temperature profile, and reasonable radiative opacities, you find that radiation plays a big role. And likewise, the total luminosity is essentially fixed by what the nuclear energy generation is doing. And so the difference between those two, which is what convection has to carry, is actually quite small in the deep interior. And so the physical picture is that you have a body that's everywhere convective, but you still have this inner region that is relatively quiescent. And so you could imagine that this will play a big role in the field geometry as well. These flows act quite effectively as magnetic dynamos. If you put it in any reasonable seed field, it's amplified by many orders of magnitude and sustained against thermic decay. You see the usual thing that as the magnetic energy grows, it reacts back on the flows. As in Ben's cases, the predominant feedback is upon the differential rotation. The convective kinetic energy remains basically the same. And in these particular simulations, so this is all dependent a little bit on magnetic Reynolds number and magnetic Crandall number and the whole business. But for simulations rotating at the solar angular velocity, you actually find fields that are slightly in excess of equipartition, so sort of 100-120% of the kinetic energy. And those fields, if you look at them, are structured on an enormous array of scales. Again, you have this discrepancy between the deep interior and the stuff near the surface, but you really see a lot of small-scale chaff, but also some large-scale features. So there's a large-scale component to the field, and if you look at that more quantitatively, we can divide the magnetic energy into its azimuthal mean and fluctuations around that mean. And if you do that, you find that the fluctuating stuff still dominates, but the mean toroidal field actually plays a non-trivial role, and it typically accounts for about 15-20% of the magnetic energy in these simulations. And that's in some ways surprising, because in the solar stuff without a tachocline, we found that generally the toroidal mean field was a tiny player, a few percent. And so you might ask where that's coming from, and certainly I think that the presence of this relatively quiescent region is playing some role. It's not just that there's differential rotation that stretches things out. You do get differential rotation in hydrodynamic progenitors. That is, if you start something like this rotating uniform rotation, it will establish sort of fast equator slope holes, but with a very strong Taylor-Kaufman constraint. But the magnetic fields in these cases are strong enough to really wipe that differential rotation out. As Sasha said earlier, that there's a range in parameter space where you can get very little feedback on the differential rotation, as in some of the solar cases without a tachocline. You can get a somewhat stronger feedback, as we saw in some of the A stars and in some of Vince papers, or you can get this other regime where the field is so effective at building the flow is so effective at building fields that it wipes out whatever differential rotation was there and really isn't impacted by that. And yet you get these large scale fields, and so there are many possible interpretations of this, but one thing to remember that I think is playing a fairly significant role relates to what Ben was talking about earlier. And it's that this business that, there's a general picture that we have that more rapid rotation helps you in building a magnetic field. And the important point to remember about these M stars is that even though I said they were rotating, this particular simulation was rotating only at the solar rate, that actually represents still a fairly strong rotational constraint. Because the luminosity is low, quite a bit lower than the solar one in these cases, the velocity is low, and so the convective turnover time is long. And so effectively the influence of rotation at fixed angular velocity is quite strong. And it's interesting that actually to detect rotation in an M-dwarf using line broadening essentially, it has to be rotating more than about 2 or 3 kilometers a second. And so you will essentially, any M dwarf in which you can detect any rotation at all is going to be in this regime or lower Rossby number. So it's always going to have this whoppingly strong rotational constraint. And we think that, you know, given both observations and theory, that that's probably playing a very significant role on both the field strength and on the geometry. So I'll basically just stop there and let you read the summary on your own. This does lead to, I should say, a few fairly direct observational predictions that we can talk about, namely that essentially any M star that you, in which you're able to detect rotation directly, should have basically no surface differential rotation and should have quite strong fields. If you're able to probe that very slow rotation regime, for instance, through photometric rotation periods, you might expect to see some differential rotation and weaker fields. I'll stop there and thanks for your time.
Just a couple of model questions. Do you have any internal heating?
So there's a nuclear energy generation term that scales as a function of temperature. So we've essentially just fit that to. So I took a 1D stellar model of a 0.3 solar mass star and attempted to match their overall epsilon as a function of radius, right, the polynomial.
Your total luminosity keeps increasing.
Right, exactly. So it increases up to about 0.4 R, something like that. So that's also certainly an effect, too, is that even in the absence of this radiative opacity, I mean, even if convection had to carry everything, you'd still, there's still a region in radius where convection wouldn't have to carry all that much energy because the total luminosity at that radius is not up to the surface level yet. But that is something that emerges from the 1D stellar model as well.
And the other thing is, do you use a constant magnetic velocity, or do you have
a... So it's a great question, actually. So as a function of radius, in the simulation I showed you here, it is constant. I've tried a few different power laws as a function of density, for instance, where we try to make it more or less viscous at different... diffusive. This is all at constant magnetic Prandtl number. So both more viscous, more diffusive, less viscous, less diffusive. And I would say that the general trend that you always have this small scale stuff near the surface and large scale stuff near the bottom is robust. The contrast between those regions can change a bit depending on how you fiddle with the viscosity, essentially. But at constant viscosity, you have this very clear asymmetry. Also, I've started to do some simulations now. Well, they have a range of simulations at a variety of rotation rates, ranging from sort of a quarter of the solar to one up to about 4 or 8 times. And you really see these trends. You see that these statements are some of the same things that Bennett's seen continue here, that at basically anything this rotation rate or more rapid, I can't find anywhere in parameter space where you retain differential rotation, for instance, except in the very weak dynamo field. At lower rotation rates, it's possible to get differential rotation in some regions in parameter space and possible to wipe it out in others, basically depending on how strong the magnetic fields are, which in turn depends on the magnetic Reynolds number and the Prandtl number and so forth.
And this is related to, I guess, to Gary's last question. A more relevant thing to plot rather than the Rossby number as a function of R is the local magnetic Reynolds number.
Sure.
And that really will,
right,
I think,
very quite a bit, right, right.
Fluctuating to me.
Yeah,
So that'd be interesting to plot.
Yeah.
It'd be a very interesting
thing. Sure.
This is actually an astronomy question.
Oh, wow.
So we're having a plot of activity
for action.
What property of the dynamo
do you think you're measuring? So I have asked that very question to the people who made that plot. This is Andrew West. And it's actually not totally trivial to sort out. My intuition... So if you look at... Actually, let me just show you something. If you look at, for instance, correlations of... You just look at chromospheric emission and its correlation with atmospheric or coronal emission and its correlation with a magnetogram, say, it seems as though this is in the sun, obviously. It seems as though the X-ray emission is dominated by the sunspot, the active region. And it's not quite as severe as that, but similar sort of thing in the chromospheric emission. That's actually a little bit misleading. It turns out that if you look at the variability of these things as a function of solar cycle, that it really seems as though the quiet sun, the stuff outside of the active region, is actually playing at least as much a role as the active regions themselves in giving you this chromospheric emission. And I think actually it's quite a bit more in solar electrons. It seems as though all you need to get chromospheric H alpha emission is a lot of small scale magnetic fields. That is, that observation does not immediately tell you that there's a large scale component, which is why you need this Feynman Doppler stuff to kind of get at the geometry. But yeah, so I would say that all it tells you for sure is that there's a lot of small scale dynamo action, and that seems to depend. I mean, the fact that you don't see it in some stars, I think, is suggestive that even that measure of which is something about small scale field does depend on rotation, because you never see. We don't know of any stars, for instance, where you're rotating very slowly. And you do see this magnetic activity, for instance. And conversely, we don't know of any stars that are rotating very rapidly until you get to sort of late end brown dwarf type stuff that are rotating very rapidly and which don't show magnetic fields. Every rapid rotator has magnetic fields. Until you get to this, there is a point where that breaks down, but we think it's due to surface conductivity effects.
Possibly a comment about perversity. The sun is familiar to us. But it may be a really nasty object to try to deal with. Because if in fact its global dynamo processes depends upon, for instance, this Packer-Klein boundary layer, as opposed to distributed magnetic activity in the bulk of the zone if it rotated faster or if it were deeper, it provides us with a major challenge, which not all stars have. Some have probably a much easier time of building large organized fields. Well, you're finding with
right, no, exactly. I mean, and the thing is that many stars rotate quite a bit more rapidly than the sun, and so it may just be that it's really only in this high Rossby number regime that you really need the boundary layers and the shear and the whole business, and that in many other cases, either at low mass or more rapidly rotating solar-like stars, that you really can get by without it. And I wouldn't claim that we totally understand that yet, but. I think it is certainly emerging from the simulation.
And if I can add, what we have also seen in these A stars, because all of these stars we have been discussing right now have a convective envelope. So you have also these stars that have a convective core and a radiative envelope. And clearly the radiative envelope seems also to be screening this magnetic dynamo going on inside. And in this core dynamo we were doing for the massive stars with mass, we are finding megagauss field. But you don't seem to be seeing them at the surface. You see perhaps a fossile field in this oblique rotator of massive stars like A stars and B stars. And we have another of Yuri's fine PhD student, Nick Friserson, who is looking at the interaction of a fossile field with radiative envelope with the convective core. And we seem to see even more dynamo action in this convective core. Like if the fossile field in the radiative interior was helping. So we are starting to have a picture of the magnetism, of stellar magnetism, which is clearly much different from what we see from the sun, and perhaps the sun, as I agree with Yuri, was a bit misleading, but there is also some connection, of course.
I think more comments?
Well, I guess, yeah, another related question. It would be interesting, probably these stars that you're talking about, like the sun, probably still have a tachocline. So a younger star, when it was rotating, probably has. If we have some of our clues about how tachyclines are established, we probably have a tachycline. And one would need to explore how some of your splendid wreaths survive when you're able to also keep pumping things into a tachycline. Do you build multiple systems?
Although, it's interesting, actually, because if the statement that the magnetic energy scales in some fashion with rotation rate is true, And you eventually, and it's also true that if you get to a point where magnetic energy can completely kill off the differential rotation, then you know it's not obvious that very young stars do have a tactical line, because if you wipe out, you know, if you kill off the differential rotation in the convective envelope, there's no reason to have fear. So
you'll still have the sort of you'll have the
tactical
line as
penetrative
too.
Right, exactly. Right. So the stability properties might be the same, and it's you know, yeah.
Okay, so this is internal discussion.
Yeah, sorry.